welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 17th of January, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, it's the beginning of another week in glorious Blighty. I hope we've passed the cold snap. It's quite sunny where I am today, and I am wondering what it's like where my co-host Max Musson from Western Spring is. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Good day to you. I'm absolutely fine, actually. It's, I think the weather is typical for what it would be like at this time of year, but this time of year is actually regarded by those in the know as the most miserable time of year, because this is the, we're sort of heading into the third week of January, which is the week in which all of the credit card bills for people's spending over the Christmas period starts to. And it's sort of fairly traditional that the FTSE index takes a little bit of a dive at this particular point of the year. And so anybody who's been looking at their investments or their pension funds or anything of that sort in recent days will have noticed that the FTSE 100 index has taken a little bit of a drop that hopefully will sort of bounce back as we go through the year. But as I say, this is regarded as being the most miserable time of year. And I think there are even statistics that show that more people commit suicide in the latter part of January than other months of the year. So what I'd hope to do is that in making this broadcast, we can help to cheer people up. And for those that are feeling forlorn and devoid of hope, hopefully we can give them hope for the future and make them feel more positive as we go into the year.
Well, I would say I should imagine that the people involved in the hospitality industry, they were very depressed over the last week. We were going to hit this topic later. Maybe we should bring it up now. It seems Boris is saying that there's going to be no more COVID restrictions, which means that the hoteliers and the people in the hospitality industry, they will be able to open their doors again. It seems that Drakeford in Wales realised that he made a bit of a mistake locking everything down over Christmas with a big scare over Omicron. So apparently Wales is going to be opening up again by the end of the month. And I fully expect that Sturgeon, wee cranky up there in Scotland, I think she's going to have to open up again as well. And I don't think they're going to be able to get away with holding another lockdown like they have. And all the talk from the experts is that Omicron is nowhere near as dangerous as the previous variants of COVID. So I think things could be brightening up on that front. But we were going to get into that when we talk about these parties that Boris Johnson had last year. I don't know if you want to make any comment on that, Max, or do you want to swap and go to the COVID parties now, or do you want to talk about Prince Harry?
Well, let's talk about the COVID parties. I think that sort of follows in logically from what we've just been saying. And it seems that Boris is taking a more cavalier attitude with regard to the COVID crisis, and a more cavalier attitude than other leaders have done in recent times. And I think he's getting a fair bit of flack for that. He is currently reeling on the ropes from body blow after body blow that's sort of hitting him about these parties and things that have been held at 10 Downing Street. And it's sad to see, but what I suppose we would expect to see, really. And one of the things that struck me is that Boris Johnson very often tries to position himself as a sort of Churchillian character. And I can imagine that over the course of the pandemic, that the staff working under him at 10 Downing Street will probably have been working longer hours than they normally would have done. You know, it could even be that some of them during very critical moments have been working virtually round the clock in order to make sure that the testing kits are available for the National Health Service, that the drugs and this, that are available, the
PPE, all that sort of stuff.
There's the PPE as well. But also the vaccines are available. That was a word I just couldn't quite get my head around for the moment. The vaccines are available, etc. And it's been obvious from the interviews of other ministers over the course of the the pandemic period, that there have been periods where they've been absolutely rushed off their feet and putting in a monumental effort in order to try and get the pandemic under control. And people have likened the pandemic to a kind of a war against the virus, and we as the public have been urged to adopt a kind of defiant blitz kind of spirit in order to maintain our morale and to keep on going in the same way that our parents' generation and our grandparents' generations during the Second World War were urged to keep their spirits high during the darkest days of the blitz, etc. And one of the principles, though, of man management is that at times when your troops have been putting in a greater than normal effort, at times when they're starting to flag as a result of the effort that they've had to sustain over a significant period of time, and their morale starts to drop, that it's a good principle to provide them with a treat, to in some cases provide a party, as Boris Johnson appears to have authorised here with regard to 10 Downing Street. But I can recall from an anecdote General Montgomery during the Second World War had a habit of providing his troops with free barrels of beer whenever their morale started to flag, and this was a principle that's and this is a principle that is a well established principle in man management. And so I think that on an instinctive level, Boris accepts the fact that this is the way to lift people's spirits when they are involved in a very sort of critical campaign and working above and beyond the call of duty. But on an intellectual level, he lacks the courage, I think, and the determination to just spit in the eye of his detractors and say, look, you know, we have delivered the vaccines to a far faster and far more widely amongst the population in Britain than virtually any other country in the world. So we have responded in a superior way. We've been putting in a great effort in getting superior results. And as part of my discretion as the commander in chief, so to speak, of the staff that were working in 10 Downing Street, I authorised these parties in order to maintain the morale. If he turned around and he just spat in the eye of the people, his detractors, instead of, you know, claiming not to know anything about it, I mean, it is possible he didn't know anything about it, I suppose, but it doesn't seem to me to be likely. But, you know, he needs to just round on the people that are attacking him and just say, look, I've delivered the vaccine. I've succeeded to a much higher degree than any other leader around the world in terms of combating the pandemic. And it should have been up to me to use my discretion in terms of rewarding my staff in order to maintain their output during that critical period. Well, that's what I think he should do.
They certainly have been going for him. I mean, it's really been something to see. It's like a full blast. Each day there's been a new revelation of another party that was going on in number 10 Downing Street. The night before, the Queen was all left on her own at her husband's funeral. And all the talk shows have been wheeling people on, talking about how they weren't able to have someone at their loved one's side while they were dying in hospital, and Boris is all to blame. He's the one that killed them. And I'm just thinking, look, I mean, what happened? They basically invited some people to the garden, people that were working together anyway. So it was like it was like the people that you work with going to your same place of work, but going outside and having a few drinks. And they were told to bring their own bottle, you know, bring their own drink so that they weren't sharing drinks. Okay, at the time, we weren't allowed to meet people outside, but we were allowed to work. People were being encouraged to go into work. And of course, you're going to be meeting the people that you are working with. So they're really attacking him. Then you have to sort of question, why is it? Are they attacking him? What has Boris Johnson done to be attacked so much by the mainstream media? I mean, he appears to have done all the right things. He's done the lockdown. He's got everybody vaccinated. He's doing what they demand of him. Dominic Cummings is no longer there. And I think these leaks actually came from Dominic Cummings about these parties as well. And then you have to look at what else is going on in Europe. And you look at Austria, where they've pretty much made it illegal to remain vax-free. You look at Germany, they've done exactly the same thing. In Canada, they're going to be fining, I think, $1,000 a month anybody who remains vax-free. In Australia, you've got these lockdowns. You've got this terrible treatment of Novak Djokovic. And you've got they've actually got quarantine camps over there. And you think, well, perhaps they were wanting Boris to do the same in Britain. And maybe Boris has actually been preventing that from happening. Because if you think when with Wales and Scotland, they both jumped straight into lockdown mode again as soon as we were told about this Omicron coming from South Africa. And all Boris Johnson said is, people should wear a mask. We'll say that people should wear a mask again. He didn't actually say, well, we're going to shut down the restaurants like they have in Wales. He didn't cancel New Year's Eve like they did in Scotland. And I'm thinking maybe they're annoyed at him for not doing this, because he's actually sort of more on the mild side when you think of the COVID tyranny that's been going on. And then you think maybe it's backfired on them now as well, because of this push against him. He's now thinking, well, I have to play to the support of the anti-lockdown crowd. And he's saying, well, there's going to be no more restrictions. We're going to open up again. There will be no more restrictions at all from now. To gain the support from our people, basically, instead of gaining support from the progressive left-wing types that want to see more lockdowns and more COVID tyranny. So, I mean, everybody seems to be attacking him at the moment, but I think, you know, maybe he's done quite well to not lock everything down. And now by them pushing him like this and saying how terrible he is for allowing these parties to go ahead, he's now thinking, well, I have to play to the support of the conservatives that don't want the lockdowns, and I have to get them back on board. And I think maybe some of the 1922 committee and some of the more old school Tories, they're the ones that don't want the lockdowns as well. And they're the ones that have had to see this call for a vote of no confidence in him, which happened, I believe, a few days ago. There were enough letters to call for a vote of no confidence in him. So perhaps perhaps he hasn't done too badly out of this. You got any thoughts on that?
I think where the government have gone wrong is that they have been, they haven't stood up to the demands of the panel of scientific advisors that have been advising them and that have been asking for more draconian restrictions. And I think that a lot of people are angry that they followed the rules and that they allowed their loved ones to die alone and weren't able to attend and be at their bedside when they died. And a lot of people are angry that they weren't able to sit next to and comfort their relatives during the funerals of people that have died. And I think that anger is quite an understandable anger to have. And I do sympathize very greatly with those people. One of the things I would say, though, is that we have become, in recent decades, too compliant as a nation of people. We've allowed our government to slowly create to slowly introduce a lot of police state measures that are there to coerce and control the population. And one of the areas where we fell down was in too many people complying with these rules that they were not able to be at their loved one's bedside. I think that we should have rebelled against that far more vigorously than we did. I think that that people shouldn't have tolerated a government interfering in their own personal family grief. And there should have been demonstrations against it. There should have been perhaps riots against it. And people should have just defied anybody who was trying to stand in their way and prevent them from being there. And I don't think it's the business of government to tell people whether or not they can attend a funeral, whether or not they can comfort their loved ones in a funeral, when there's been a death in the family. And that they certainly shouldn't be able to dictate whether or not we can actually attend a hospital and sit at the bedside of a dying relative.
I think a lot of it has been, you know, how dare you be happy while we've had this going on? That seems to be a lot of it, because, I mean, the reasons for not letting people into the hospitals is because they didn't want people to catch the virus is in the hospitals, that sort of thing. But what you had going on with these parties, you had people that were working in that area, they were working at number 10, and they were invited to the garden at number 10, which was open. So it wasn't like they were saying, well, they can really all the people that work for Boris Johnson can do something completely different to everyone else. And I think there's a certain element of, we had a very harsh time of it. So you should not have been seen to be having a happy time of it. I think there's an element of that to it.
I appreciate that, but I think that we have as a nation become too compliant. We have become too obedient, and so that when governments tell us to do something, that we just roll over and do it. Whereas in other countries, like in France and Germany, there have been far more demonstrations against government policy, and I think we as a people need to draw a lesson from what's happened over the last year, and to recognise that there is a limit to what the government can legitimately interfere in our lives. And if the government interferes too far, then, you know, we need to demonstrate against it. We need to rebel against it, and we need to put the government back in its place as a servant of the people, rather than the lording over us and telling us what we can and cannot do. And I think that where people do feel bitterly grieved about the fact that they were forced into a situation where they had to let a loved one die alone, then their anger should be directed into making a personal resolution that they will not allow a similar interference in their natural freedoms in the future in other respects.
Well, they did have riots last year at this time, but it wasn't riots at not being able to be at their loved one's side when they died in the hospital. It was riots over George Floyd, wasn't it? And you had the Labour Party supporting this. You had Labour Party MPs supporting this, and there were thousands of people on the streets rioting and destroying things. And then you've got all this upset over these workers going to the garden of number 10. And perhaps it is the rioting that they've actually seen in places like Holland and Germany and Austria. I mean, there's been some very violent altercations between the protesters and the police, and perhaps Boris Johnson is not wanting that here, and that's why he hasn't pushed for vaccine passports and mandatory vaccinations. I mean, they've pretty much got mandatory vaccinations in these other countries, and he's managed to prevent that so far from happening here. So his libertarian side is really showing there. I mean, if you could call it that. I mean, you shouldn't be compelled to do medical procedures that you don't want in the first place. But but everybody just seems to be going along with that. Seems to have forgotten that this vaccine is experimental, and we don't know what the long-term results of taking it are going to be. At least he hasn't. At least he hasn't forced us into that. But yeah, yes, I do. I do think people should have resisted more and protested more. We don't seem to have that large an anti-lockdown, anti-COVID tyranny movement in this country. But then it doesn't get covered, does it? I mean, I do know that there are protests that go on in London, but you just don't hear about them on the BBC. They pretend that they're not actually happening. Do you want to move on to Prince Harry, or do you want to add any more onto that, Max?
No, I think we've done as much as we need to do on that. The story that broke today about Prince Harry is that he's now apparently taking legal action against, I'm not sure whether it's actually the royal family or whether it's against the government, but he's taking legal action in order to have his police protection returned to him when he visits the UK. And I just think that it's, you know, rather hypocritical to abdicate your position within the royal family because you want to be a private citizen, and then claim that as a private citizen you don't get the same perks that you used to get as a member of the royal family, i.e. Personal protection for yourself and your wife and children, and to then take legal action in order to have that privilege returned to you. It just seems to me to be hypocritical. it tends to suggest as well that Prince Harry's got a rather inflated view of his own importance. I don't see him as the sort of character that ought to be that afraid of anybody of being attacked when he comes to the UK. I don't think his itinerary gets published before he arrives here, so nobody's going to know where he's going anyway. He would just appear and he would do whatever he wants to do, and he would leave before anybody's got time to organise anything about it. That's how I would see it. But you know, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of ordinary people around the country who get involved in public life, who do try to organise politically, who do become minor and local political figures, and who also face death threats. You know, death threats usually are without substance. People make death threats because they know that it's going to, that they hope that it's going to make you feel scared and worried in the future. But my experience is that death threats are usually hollow threats, and they're not followed through with. And if everybody in the country that had ever had a death threat made against them was to curl up in a ball and wither away and die, you know, we would have a massive decrease in the population of Britain. So the fact of the matter is that the vast majority of ordinary people, when they receive threats against their person, or when they receive death threats, just shrug them off. And certainly from what most MPs tell us, that they get sort of death threats on a sort of a regular basis, at least once a week, some of them have stated. And, you know, and if they can continue to function without having the levels of police protection that are normally provided for the royal family, then I don't see why Prince Harry should get that sort of protection.
Well, I've heard that he's actually complaining that he's not going to be given intelligence briefings from the Secret Service of what's going on in the country. So, I mean, why would a private individual expect to be given intelligence briefings? And I believe that the source of this problem is that he has an American security team, and an American security team has guns, of course. And if you come into Britain, you can't have guns. Only the police can have guns, and only the special police armed unit can have guns. So he wants to have his security team here, but he wants them to have guns. And that is the same rule for anybody. Anybody that comes over here from America, any famous celebrity or whatever, that they, and they have a security team, they're not allowed to have guns. They're not allowed to have, they're not allowed to fire weapons, basically. And he's expecting that he should be able to have a security team, an armed security detail to follow him around. And he's being treated the same as everybody else, and quite rightly so. He should just be treated the same as everybody else. Prince Andrew, he's dropped his titles now as well. He's not going to be going to any more royal functions. And he says he's going to be fighting these accusations. So I don't know if he's actually going to end up in court with this Virginia Giuffre. That came out last week as well. But he's now in the same situation that Prince Harry is. He's lost all his royal titles, apart from the fact that he is actually a prince. You can't take that away from him. But he's lost his Royal Highness bit. So I don't know what his concerns are about security, or whether he still has security. But
my understanding is that Prince Andrew will continue to have police security until this case with Virginia Giuffre is resolved.
Yeah, I mean, that's okay for him. But Harry should just come over here with his security detail without weapons and see what it's like for everybody else. He wants to live like the common people, doesn't he? He wants to be seen as a common people and no longer like a prince. Well, you know, he has to live like it. And the common people don't get intelligence briefings, and they don't have armed police.
Maybe that security people in the United States need to have guns, because there are quite a lot of guns available, and guns are more freely available in the United States than they are over here. But due to the restrictions that there are on gun ownership in this country, I would think that it's highly unlikely that it's much less likely that there would be an armed attack against Prince Harry in any event. And so therefore, having an unarmed security team should be sufficient.
Yeah, it should be. It's bizarre that he's complaining about this. We've got another news story here as well that you were telling me about, Max, and this is to do with the BBC TV license and Nadine Dorries. I think Nadine Dorries is okay. She's sort of worked her way up from being working class and being in a council house to being a Conservative Party MP, and she does seem slightly traditionalist minded, and they put her in charge of the BBC, in charge of culture, I believe, but she's not really hard enough to really go after them, unfortunately, I don't think. And you were saying she's done something to do with the TV licence? What's she done with that?
Well, she's the culture secretary, and she has announced that she's going to impose a 2-year freeze on the BBC television licence, and so and the BBC obviously are upset about this. Now, the figures that were quoted as to what this is going to cost the BBC didn't seem to add up when I was reading through, and so I won't really comment on the or try and quantify what the what difference the freeze on the licence fee would make, but the reason for this is allegedly due to left-wing bias on the BBC or in the BBC. And I think there a comparison has been made to the amount of time and broadcast minutes that have been applied to attacking Boris Johnson over the fact that there have been these parties at 10 Downing Street, compared with the very, very minuscule amount of broadcast minutes that were devoted to exposing alleged breaches of the COVID regulations on the part of Keir Starmer. I can recall a few days back seeing a video that was published in one of the news websites, which alleged to show that Keir Starmer was at a party. It did appear to be him. It was some video that was taken through a window, so the person that took it was taking the video on the QT, but it did appear to show Keir Starmer having a beer, standing in close proximity to two other people at what appeared to be a party. And so it appears that what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander, I suppose, and perhaps the calls for Boris to pay the price for parties that took place at 10 Downing Street will lose some of their gusto. They probably would lose some of their gusto almost certainly if the BBC were to pay as much attention to what Keir Starmer's doing as they do to what Boris Johnson's doing.
The BBC are insufferably left-wing. I watch EastEnders. I am loath to admit it. It's one of my my secret vices is watching EastEnders, and at the moment on there they have this storyline about a neo-Nazi terrorist. Not just any neo-Nazi terrorist, he has a cell of neo-Nazi terrorists, and not just a cell, apparently there's lots of them all up and down the country, and they do special operations, and they blow up mosques, and they blow up gay bars. And I mean, have you ever heard of a white supremacist neo-Nazi terrorist blowing up a gay bar or blowing up a mosque in Britain? No, I haven't heard of that. I have heard of Muslims blowing up nail bombs and blowing up buses and trying to blow up trains, but I haven't heard of anyone trying to blow up a gay bar. Although I did hear that there was once, a couple of years back, there was a news story about a young lad, and the young lad had made a threat to blow up the pub at the end of his road, and it was a gay pub. And this plot was actually foiled. And the reason why it was foiled is because the nationalists in the chat room, where he was making his threats to go and blow the pub up, told the police about it. So the nationalists stopped this from actually going off. I don't know whether it would have actually happened or not, but it shows that the nationalists, who get the blame for everything and we get called all these nasty names, we don't want terrorism to go off. But that's the only thing that I can think that comes anywhere close to this storyline. The whole storyline is just there to try and portray nationalists as bad people. Of course, this cell have also beaten up a taxi driver. They've beaten up a sandwich stall owner. The taxi driver was Muslim, I think, the sandwich stall owner. He was black. They've gone after a black teacher as well, and they just want to hurt people, and apparently they want to send a message by blowing up this future mosque. And now apparently EastEnders is going to have a mosque on the set, and of course they have a young white lad who is a Muslim, and he has a young white girlfriend who is the neo-Nazi's sister, and she's all putting a hijab on, and the father ends up calling the police on his son and saying, this isn't how I brought you up, you know, not to be against your sister going out with a Muslim. And it's just the opposite of reality. The complete opposite of reality is what they're actually portraying on there. And I think
let me just bring to your attention that in 1999 there was a wave of bombings of gay bars in London. I think there were about three bars that were actually bombed by a chap called what was his name now? Gosh, it's just disappeared now. Copeland, that's right. His surname was Copeland, and he acted just entirely on his own, but he did set off some nail bars. And according to my recollection, there were people that were seriously injured as a result of it and lost limbs and things of that sort. I can't quite remember whether anybody died. I think perhaps they might have done. But that was something that was very prominent in the news at that point in time. But it was just Copeland acting completely on his own. And so this again is one of these instances where people who are motivated by hatred, if they don't have any legal means of expressing themselves, because the law against alleged hate speech is such that people can't sort of express themselves, and so people tend to bottle up any hatreds that they have, and this sometimes manifests itself in an individual just going off the rails because they don't think, you know, that they become nihilistic and they think that nobody understands the issue or nobody regards the issue as important in the way that they do. And this case has very often been cited as a reason why the government's approach to counterterrorism needs to be modified. And the way it needs to be modified is in this respect, that as far as Islamic terrorism is concerned, the Islamic terrorists are recognized by the government as being extremist individuals, or a small percentage of the Islamic population of this country who are extremist and who want to visit violence against other people, whereas the vast majority of people who are Muslims are regarded by the government as being good people. Whereas if you look at the alternative, where there are people who are campaigning for the rights of the indigenous British people, anybody who campaigns for the rights of the indigenous British people is regarded by the police as being a criminal. And so there is no distinction made between those people who are so extreme that they're prepared to perform acts of terrorism and those people who just merely wish to voice their feelings on a particular subject. And so what the government need to do is that they need to apply the restrictions that they do on extremism even-handedly, and recognize that there are people who are white nationalists, who are very rational people, who are very peaceful people, and who wish to achieve their ends by legitimate political means, and they should accord those people the same rights that they accord the leaders of the Muslim community in this country, and regard them as good people. And in that way, that will then create the incentive for people who are moderate leaders of white nationalism in this country. It would lead them to support the police far more than perhaps we do now.
That's a very good point that you make there. And as you were saying there, it's when people feel that they don't have a voice, they don't have anybody that's speaking up for them, that they get pushed towards the extremism. So if you're going to censor websites, censor podcasts, and prevent groups like Patriotic Alternative from passing the Electoral Commission, then people are going to think, well, we've got nobody speaking up for me. And that will push people towards extremism. You know, and I have to reiterate, this attack that was going to be on a gay pub, that was stopped because the people in the chat room told the police about it, because there was a chat room that nationalists were talking in, and we want to prevent extremism and terrorism from happening just as much as anybody else, and yet, as you say there, Max, all nationalists are portrayed as as being the bad guys, that there's no sort of moderate nationalists. And really, what that's what they should be doing with these young lads that they, that they get taken in to prevent because they're concerned that they might get involved in extremism. They should be saying, well, you should be getting involved in your community, in a community-based group that is standing up for the indigenous British people and who wants to have legal democratic change, and get involved with them. And say to them, well, there is a choice. You can either go your extremism route, or you can go the other peaceful, legitimate route. But to say that all nationalism is extremism, then that doesn't give people that choice, and it encourages extremism. And then when you put false narratives on the TV in shows like EastEnders, you know, that pushes people towards that, doesn't it? It says, well, that's what you do if you want change. You know, that there's no peaceful democratic change that's shown on there. That there's just, you know, these horrible, nasty people that want to blow up mosques and blow up gay bars. But again, it just shows this left wing bias at the BBC. People are disgusted at the BBC at being lectured to by this TV company that they pay for, that they are taxed for. So I do hope she puts a limit on the TV license and it doesn't go up. They shouldn't be getting any money for that anyway. They were supposed to pay for all the pensioners to have free TV licenses. The government said, we'll pay for the pensioners to have their free TV licenses for the next, I forget what it was, 5 years or the next 10 years. And at the end of that, the BBC has to pay for it. And I can remember this being the agreement, the deal. This was the deal that was reached with the BBC. And it came to the end of the 5 years, or it came to the end of the 10 years, and they said, oh, well, we can't afford it now. The pensioners are going to have to start paying for their TV licence again. And the BBC is still going. The BBC is still able to collect its licence, and it went back on the deal. I think that's disgusting. I don't think pensioners should have to pay for a TV license. And if people are going to pay for a TV license, we are going to have to pay for it, then it should not be showing this bias. It should not be showing this preference. It should be treating all points of view equally, and it should be encouraging tolerance for different points of view, not demonizing people with a different point of view. But anyway, that's a subject for another day, I think. Do you want to add anything else to our weekly roundup of the news, Max, or shall we get into our Greatest Britons?
Let's get into our Greatest Britons.
Okay, our Greatest Briton for this week is, once again, Lord William Leverholm, or Leverholm. I was told last week that in actual fact, because I thought the word was lever, that may have just been because of the local accent where I heard it being referred to. And I have had other people tell me that it is actually Leverholm and it's Unilever. So it was just in the part of the country where I was working at the time that people were referring to it as Unilever. So I shall try to refer to it as Leverholm this week. So we'll start with a recap. Last episode, we heard how William was the son of a teetotal greengrocer, and he followed in the footsteps of his father, eventually becoming a salesman for the business before the company expanded into making its own soap. Lever were the first to produce soap in its own packets, and their brand was called Sunlight Soap. By 1887, they were needing their own factory for soap making, and in keeping with William's ideas about moral capitalism, he made sure to build a village for his employees nearby to the factory. This was not cheap accommodation for employees to simply sleep in. It was a model village, meaning it was intended to be as perfect a place to live as possible. This was quite a common thing at the time, with patriotic-minded employers doing their best to help raise their fellow countrymen to a higher standard of living. And that's where we got to last week. Is there anything you'd like to add to that, Max?
Just to emphasise the fact that William Leverholm wasn't the only person doing this, that there was this Garden City movement at the time where a number of capitalists developed a form of benevolent capitalism where they felt that it was part of their duty not just to provide employment for their workforce, but also to create a healthy environment for them to live in, so that not only did the company benefit from the hard work and profits that were generated, but also so that the workers benefited from that as well.
It's something they were really proud of as well. The actual first turf that was dug with a silver shovel. And Leverholm and his wife, they went across on a special barge to the plot of land, and his wife was the first to actually use this shovel. He took a hands-on approach with this. He was involved in every part of this, and he was particularly proud of it. The model village was actually called Port Sunlight, and it is still there, and we'll take a look at it now. From 1888, Port Sunlight Village offered decent living conditions in the belief that good housing would ensure a healthy and happy workforce. The community was designed to house and support the workers. Life in Port Sunlight included intrusive rules and implied mandatory participation in activities, and the tied cottages meant that a worker losing his or her job could be almost simultaneously evicted. And of course, this comes from Wikipedia, so they're trying to make out that it was a really bad place to live. It wasn't. It was a lovely place to live, and they could decide on the rules and the laws that that they wanted. He didn't tell people that they were going to get kicked out if they misbehaved or anything like that. He didn't put people that were likely to misbehave actually in the village. It was like a reward. For if you were a really good worker and you put everything you had into your job, then you would be asked if you wanted to move into this village. And by all accounts, the people that were in there were extremely happy. In some matters, Lever was keen to allow the residents of Port Sunlight a degree of democratic control. And this seems to have led to a common conviction that he was in favour of women's suffrage, a belief that possibly stems from a situation arising in connection to the Bridge Inn, a Port Sunlight temperance pub that was opened in 1900. Lever was a lifelong teetotaler, and he naturally assumed that the bridge would be, quote, dry. So I guess at the time they had a craze for pubs that didn't actually have drinking in, because they had the temperance movement, which was anti-alcohol. But within 2 years of its opening, representations were made to change its status to a licensed house. Lever promptly announced that he would not impose his own views, and that the issue would be decided by a referendum, insisting somewhat unconventionally for that time that women could take part. With the added proviso that the bridge would only become a true British pub if a supermajority of 75% was in favour. Lever probably felt confident that the outcome would support his abstemious sentiments. But in the event, more than 80% voted for an alcohol licence, and even though some people petitioned Lever, urging him to use his absolute authority in Port Sunlight and ignore the referendum, he refused to do so. Good man. I like the way that he still retains the absolute authority. So he has this democratic will, but he can also put a stop to it if necessary.
A true democrat paying for the creation of Port Sunlight and then still supporting the people that lived there, even though they made a decision that went against its principles. And this it was quite common amongst the families who tended to have this attitude of benevolent capitalism. They very often they did tend to be teetotalers, because a lot of them were Quaker families, and they disagreed with the drinking of alcohol for religious reasons. I know that Welwyn Garden City and Letchworth were created that didn't have any public houses in them whatsoever initially. Both those towns now do have public houses, but in the centre of the towns, where in any other similarly sized town there would be quite a large number of public houses, they tend to have just very, very few of them. And so I guess those public houses have greater demand, and so therefore are on a more profitable footing than other public houses might be in other places.
Well, I think they wanted people to be the best people that they could possibly be. They wanted to encourage good habits in them. They wanted them to live in beautiful surroundings and do their own gardening and keep their own animals. I mean, some of these places, each house had a pigsty, and they had ways to improve yourself there, library there, swimming pool there. There was all sorts of facilities that they built there in this village as well. So I think there was this big encouragement to be the very best person that you could possibly be. So you wouldn't really want to encourage people to get drunk, but If they wanted to have a pub there, if they wanted to have a drink, then they were welcome to have a drink. Lever himself, he used to sleep in the outdoors. And in one of the castles that he lived at, he actually removed half the walling so that it was open to the sky. And apparently he was like that for his whole life. He wanted to sleep in the open air. So he had removed the windows in the buildings that he was actually living in. He was somewhat of an eccentric, which I think is a great thing. You know, the British are well known for being eccentric. But I don't think he forced this on everybody in Port Sunlight. They had functioning windows in their houses.
And I mentioned last week about the village of Stewartby in Bedfordshire, about how it looks like a sort of a life-sized toy village. And that there's a style of building that has been employed in Stewartby, which is very characteristic of that particular village. But I've also noticed that there are lots of estates scattered around Bedfordshire that are owned by the Duke of Bedford, and where houses were built by the Duke of Bedford as tied cottages for his estate workers. And those tied cottages are constructed to the same basic style and are of a very similar size to the cottages that were provided in Stewartby, and it's well worth it if you sort of visit in that area, just having a look at going to Stewartby and having a look at the style of building and just imagining the way in which our society could have developed from that point onwards, where it could have been that social housing would have been constructed of that type, and council houses and houses for for people of limited means, etc. Social housing, that's what I was striving for. If social housing was all constructed to that sort of style, it would make a very stylish housing stock for this country, I think it would have been good had that happened.
Well, you imagine what some of the housing was like at the time, that the slums, and this was the opposite of that, and the idea of putting people one on top of the other in skyscrapers and blocks of flats, I don't think anybody would have wanted to do that back then. Everybody lived one on top of the other. You wanted to have space. You wanted to make it conducive to enjoyment of life. In reality, workers' social lives were policed from the head office, and some of Lever's employees clearly resented his paternalism. However well-intentioned, the power it afforded the company, even though it was rarely exercised, was viewed as an attack on workers' liberty and human rights. Although many such people preferred to find their own accommodation, there were others who, for whatever reason, were never given an opportunity to reside in Port Sunlight. Perhaps Lever's observations on this matter are revealing. And he said, "The private habits of an employee have really nothing to do with Lever Brothers, providing the man is a good workman. At the same time, a good workman may have a wife of objectionable habits, or he may have objectionable habits himself, which make it undesirable to have him in the Port Sunlight village." So it was only if you were, you know, if you were, had a good character and you were of high morals that you would actually be put in this village. So, you know, you would have good neighbours if you went there. So it was like a reward. And I think they tried to put it down today. Wikipedia tries to put it down, I think, saying that it's an attack on workers' liberty and human rights. I doubt very much whether they saw it as that. I think they would have seen it as what a great employer, providing us with a cheap house, a beautiful house, in far greater condition than the houses of the people that work in the other factories.
Yeah.
Viscount Leverholm personally supervised planning the village and employed nearly 30 different architects. I mean, he's put a lot of money into this. It was cheaper to build houses back then. But he's you know, trying to build the very best houses and make the best village that he can. 30 different architects. Between 1899 and 1914, 800 houses were built to house a population of 3,500. And one of the reasons why there were all these different architects, he wanted every house to look different as well. So everybody had their own unique house. The garden village had allotments and public buildings, including the Lady Lever Art Gallery, a cottage hospital, schools, a concert hall, open-air swimming pool, church, and a temperance hotel. Lever introduced welfare schemes and provided for the education and entertainment of his workforce, encouraging recreation and organizations which promoted art, literature, science, or music. Now, it doesn't sound to me as if this is against the workers' human rights and taking away their liberties. It sounds to me as if he's cares a lot about these people and he's trying to raise them up in the world. The aims of Lord Leverholm, as he became, were to socialise and Christianise business relations and get back to that close family brotherhood that existed in the good old days of hand labour. So, and that's something that was lost with the Industrial Revolution, wasn't it? The sense of being an artisan and producing the whole product yourself. And you pointed this out before, Max, with this sort of working on a factory line and not having much self-respect and not knowing how to sort of build the whole product in the end of it. So he's trying to get back that sense of self-worth that the workers actually had, and to get them involved in the work, and to get them feeling like they're doing a good thing. So it's not just that they're doing it for wages.
This ties in with the teachings of Robert Blatchford and the Clarion movement that we had earlier.
And what time is that? Because this is about 1900. So that was before then, wasn't it? Slightly before then.
Yes, I think it was the 1890s and probably was as well the early 1900s.
So that would have tied in. He would have been influenced by him then, I would have thought.
Yes, almost certainly.
He claimed that Port Sunlight was an exercise in profit sharing, but rather than share profits directly, he invested them in the village. He said it would not do you much good if you send it down your throats in the form of bottles of whiskey, bags of sweets, or fat geese at Christmas. On the other hand, if you leave the money with me, I shall use it to provide for you everything that makes life pleasant. Nice houses, comfortable homes, and healthy recreation. And again, that makes sense that rather than just having a small bit for each person to spend on, which they can't really buy very much, if he's got a large bag full of money there, he can put it to good use, buying things that are going to help everybody out. Rather than an individual having a small windfall, everybody's got a windfall there, a large windfall. If you think about it, swimming pool, concert hall, hospital, schools. And the historical significance of Port Sunlight lies in its combination of model industrial housing, providing materially decent conditions for working people, with the architectural and landscape values of the garden suburb influenced by the ideas of William Morris and the arts and crafts movement. Each block of houses was designed by a different architect. The backs of any of the houses cannot be seen, and each house is unique. In terms of architectural features, there is half timbering, carved woodwork and masonry, pargetting or ornamental plasterwork, moulded and twisted chimneys, and leaded glazed patterns. Some of the houses were built in Flemish style with bricks imported from Belgium. He's really showing these people how much he thinks of them, isn't he?
Yes. Yeah. I've been in houses of this sort, as I say, throughout Bedfordshire. There are lots of houses of this sort that are on the Duke of Bedford's estate and in Stuart being similar places. And I've been inside a lot of these houses, and it's exactly what you've described there. You know, there is these leaded-like windows, half timbering, lots of there's like wood paneling inside some of the houses as well, and the twisted chimneys, etc., with patterning, etc., on the outside to make the properties look really attractive. And a lot of people, you know, there's a great premium for, you know, if anybody is a tied worker or living in tied accommodation in any of these houses, and they leave and that house becomes vacant, lots of people apply to either move in as a tenant or apply to purchase the properties, and they do command a higher price than other similarly sized properties because of their attractive design.
Well, it certainly sounds like it. I mean, these houses are still there today. There's still a community there today. They've still got the art museum there. I mean, he's put all these artworks there for people to look at. He wants to get people involved in culture as well. He was also known for being a Freemason, and this is really interesting. In 1902, he became the first initiate of a Freemason's lodge that he built bearing his name, which was built in Port Sunlight. So this is after he's actually become a very wealthy businessman, a very, very good businessman. And then he becomes a Freemason, but it's not like he's been asked to become a Freemason. He builds his own Freemason's lodge and he's the first initiate in it. Which I don't know if that's a very common thing to do. Maybe he was hoping to be asked to become a Freemason, but hadn't been. I mean, most people that are involved in business, they are Freemasons. And he sort of worked his way around it by building his own lodge and naming it after himself and then becoming a Freemason. And this is after he's already done all his business. In 1907, he became Worshipful Master, and he went on to found many lodges and hold various offices at national level. And in 1919, he was appointed Senior Grand Warden of the Grand Lodge of Master Masons of England. And he was also Provincial Senior Grand Warden of the Provincial Grand Lodge of Cheshire and founded many other lodges. And I just find that incredible. To not have actually started off as a Freemason and to have built your own lodge and done this and then gone on, after you've already become a successful businessman, to get involved with the Masons. The Masons must have liked him, basically, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, any thoughts on this, Max?
Well, yeah, I mean, it may well be that he was trying to introduce the what he would see as the benefits of Masonry to the workers that he had in that lived in Port Sunlight. Yeah, it is an unusual way of going about things, creating your own Masonic lodge. And perhaps he saw the Masonic movement and felt that it could be done better, and so initially wanted to gain a foothold in Masonry, and did this by creating his own lodge, and then used his influence to reform some of the lodges that he perhaps felt could do the job better.
I mean, it did have quite a good reputation in Britain, really, up until this time, and it was the French Freemasonry that was involved in the Bolshevik Revolution and the French Revolution. There was I forget what the difference of it. There's two different types of Freemasonry. There's one that emanates from London, and there's another one that emanates from France, and the British one had a better reputation than the French one. And there are a lot of charitable people that are involved with it. And on the surface, it is a charitable institution. Well, after that, there was a media conspiracy against him. By 1905, many of the raw materials used in the manufacture of soap were being used by makers of margarine and other new products. And in early 1906, it was clear that this increased demand was not temporary, and prices rose sharply. Concern in the soap-making industry was widespread, and in some cases acute. Competition became fierce, leading to increases in advertising expenses, which served only to exacerbate an already critical situation. Lever himself considered, and then rejected, some rather drastic alterations to the Sunlight formula, eventually deciding on reducing the weight of the standard bar. In July 1906, he was asked to attend a meeting in Liverpool called by a group of soap makers based in the north of England. The result was an accord to put in motion changes that would effectively cartelise the industry by stifling competition and controlling prices to the consumer. Lever attempted to rationalise the formation of the Soap Trust by claiming that the industry would become more efficient, thus making cost savings that could then be passed on to the consumer, assertions that could never be realised. Financial manoeuvres made by Lever were designed to maximise the Lever brothers' position within the cartel, included takeovers and share issues, but as more people became aware of their plans, it was inevitable that information would be leaked to the press. Nevertheless, retrenchments were set in motion, including the cancellation of several substantial press advertising campaigns. By October, several newspapers were publishing articles about the Soap Trust, and some began to represent Lever as a leading character in an infamous conspiracy. Headlines in the Daily Mail, the Daily Mirror, and the Evening News proclaimed Soap Trust Arithmetic, how 15 ounces make a pound. Dismissal of employees begins, and Trust Soap Already Dearer. Other allegations included claims that the Trust was trying to control the available supplies of raw materials and that it was preparing to use unsavoury substances in its soaps. Port Sunlight, parodied as Port Moonshine, was portrayed as a sweatshop. Reports by disgruntled retailers were given prominent positions and readers were urged to buy products made by non-Trust manufacturers. I mean, this is quite serious. And again, you think if he was a Freemason, maybe they wouldn't have been doing this against him. They've obviously got a dislike for him somehow. And I think he probably would have actually passed the savings on to the consumer. And he probably thought this was a good idea. The campaign had a surprisingly rapid and strikingly negative impact on the member companies, particularly on Lever Brothers businesses. By November 1906, Lever sales had fallen by 60% compared with the previous year, and Lever Brothers shares had lost around 25% of their value. Other members of the combine experienced similar devastating declines. Such conditions inevitably led to a reassessment of the position, and following a meeting of all firms involved in the alliance, but without the wholehearted approval of Lever himself, a decision was made to bring the organisation to an end. Most of the members of the failed cartel found their reputations seriously tarnished and none escaped financial damage. Lever estimated his losses at considerably over $500,000. For Northcliffe, this was clearly a victory of liberty over iniquity, a view reflected in the Daily Mail's headline, "Public Opinion Smashed the Soap Trust." And I don't think it was public opinion. I think this was the newspapers ganging up on it. And it's not just me that thought that either, but go on, Max.
I suspect this would have been a move to impose laissez-faire capitalism in place of the paternalistic capitalism that Leverholm advocated. And I think that what you'll find here is that the companies that felt that they didn't have sufficient control over the products that are needed to produce soap decided that they wanted to break the cartel that had been created, and I would imagine that the cartel that had been created was done for paternalistic reasons by Leverholm, because all of his other actions have been paternalistic. So I don't have a sort of thorough understanding of the principles involved here, but I would assume that Lord Leverholm was being paternalistic and did aim to provide the greatest benefit to the common good, but that there were hard-nosed business reasons why other capitalists wouldn't have wanted there to be some restriction or some restraint on their ability to make profits.
Well, I agree entirely. I think we can see that from the amount he put into the village for his workers. And all the effort that went into that. He's clearly looking at this paternalistically and thinking, well, this is going to get the best deal for the customers, for the consumers. And the media themselves, the newspapers, they didn't want that.
And considerably over $500,000 would probably be something like, in today's terms, around about £1 billion.
Yeah, an absolute fortune that he actually lost here. And, I mean, they accused him of the conspiracy, but it appears to me it was the newspapers that were conspiring against him. Well, he fought back against this, and we'll hear about that next week. I think we should probably leave that here for today, Max. So thank you very much for coming on today.
No, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.